We're beginning this morning a new sermon series on the book of Matthew, and I've got some pictures to start this out just because of who Matthew was. Here, I don't know how well these will come across on the screen and underneath. The people watching online, the first time you get your paycheck, I just remember I've shared this here a number of times before, just the utter shock after I'd worked making, you know, about $5 an hour. I'd worked 20 hours that week. I thought I was going to get $100 on my paycheck. Do you remember that? Do y'all remember your first paycheck that actually ran through someone else's payroll where you weren't getting paid cash by the guy next door to cut his grass or whatever? I got that first paycheck, and I thought it was going to be $100, and all right, I knew 10 was going to the Lord, and the other 90 was party time when you're in high school, right? And so I remember getting that, and it was for like $69.47 or something. I'm like, I went to the manager to complain, like, you've stolen money from me. Who's your accountant? You know, I was in and he introduced me to the dreaded FICA tax and federal income tax. And then Gaston Gaperton got his cut. You know, just walk it down. I'm aging myself a little bit, if you can remember when that guy was governor, all right? So we went down through there, and I was just like, oh, this is a terrible thing. And but then again, I mean, we got to have roads to drive on. I get that. I get it. Sometimes it just feels like they take a little too much. You know, they used to take, you know what the federal income tax was back in the 20s? 2%. And people threw an absolute fit, all right? Boy, how times have changed, right? Here's another one. I'm going to turn around and look at this one. I don't know if you can see it on the board, but it's Snoopy writing to the IRS. He says, "Dear IRS," and then he pauses, thinks, "I'm writing to you to cancel my subscription. Please remove my name from your mailing list." All right. I realize for the kids in the room, you have no idea what I'm talking about right now. But for the adults, when you go out to your mailbox and you see a letter from the IRS, you are never excited, all right? Unless you are sure there's some kind of refund check coming back. You're usually not excited about that, okay? Then here another one, the tax office. He's holding the guy's left arm in his arm. He says, "I'll be needing one of your legs as well," all right? Poor guy, you can just see he's dejected. And then this, I'm just going to let this last one speak for itself. You can interpret it however you want to. Here it goes. You ready? Once again, Fred got a little behind in his taxes. Dun-dun. So we've all felt that way. And if you haven't felt that way, someday, what can everyone say to them? You will, right? It's coming. This is assuming that you go out and get a job. I realize not everybody does that, okay? But I hope someday you feel the rest of our pain, all right? So listen, all the IRS jokes out there, they're never positive, okay? Typically, if someone says that they are a tax collector, we don't like them in our society. We don't get along, okay? But they're collecting taxes for a nation that does a lot of good things with that money, okay? We all know that there's a lot of government waste, but they do a lot of good things, helping people out, especially elderly people, people who are truly disabled, not able to work, to be able to provide medical care for people in their latter years. I mean, these are good things, to provide for a common defense in the world that we live in. These are things that are good for our taxes to go to, things that the Bible says that we should be a part of, especially for the defense. I'm not so sure that the church shouldn't be doing a lot more on the charitable end than what we are. But when we think taxes, we generally don't like it. But if you take yourself back to the first century, to the time of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when the four Gospels were written, when you read the word tax collector, it carried a whole different negative sense than what it does now. See, back in the time of the Roman Empire, a lot of times we think of the emperor, but really at the heart of Roman government was not the emperor. What group of body is well known that really watched over Rome? They were the Senate. You remember that? The Roman Senate? And so here's a picture of the senators in their garbs. There's a lot of drawings from back then that tells us how they would live together. They're a bunch of very, very wealthy men. And the way they became very, very wealthy is they took what money they had, and they funded armies to go out and conquer other nations, other people groups, and to exact tribute from them so that they wouldn't send their army in and just kill them all. It wasn't the job of Roman armies to kill people, because the army was funded by the Roman Senate. We're going to send in our armies, conquer you, then you're going to give us money for the rest of your life. So the Roman Senate wasn't very popular, and a group of them were called the Publicani. It's almost like a mafia, the Publicani. And the Publicani would get together, and they would send out an army, say to Israel, for example, and they would control that area, and it was their job to fund that army. Once they took that area over, then the army would find tax collectors in that. They would call them publicans or publicans, okay? Because those publicans would then return the money from the public back to the publicani, which would be the senators who sent in the army in the first place. Do you get that picture? Is you have this ruling government body that sends in these extortioners who rule over you, who will kill you and your family if you don't give them a certain percentage of everything that comes in from your land, your business. Anything that you bring in, they're going to get a take. And that's how Rome got so big. Let's not think for a second that Rome built all those, if you go over there and visit, all those beautiful buildings that were built back in the day, the Colosseum and the Forum and the Pantheon and all the religious, those things were built not from Roman money, but from nations whom the Romans had conquered. And the surrounding nations resented them for that because everything they had was built on the backs of slaves and people who had been extorted from their own wealth. And so when they would be sending out their armies, once they got order in the area, then they would find people from the local area who wanted a job, who would take that money from the people who knew the local people in that town. See, if they don't know the people in that town, if they don't know the ins and outs of the businesses in that town, it would be really easy to hide the money from somebody, let's say, in Washington, D.C., okay? And so what they would do is they would hire a local from that culture who would, in essence, spy out on the people to see what they were making, to know who they interacted with, and then the way you got paid is you took what the Romans wanted, and then you added 5 or 10% on top of that, so to pay your own salary. Now, how would y'all feel about that if, let's say, the Russians came in and conquered the United States, and then they hired, let's say that they hired Len Pica, because he knows everybody and what you do for a living and about what you would make for a living. And so they would come in, and Len would be like, I'd like to volunteer to take everyone else's money because I know he works over Marathon. I know what he makes. I know what a nurse at Cabell Huntington Hospital makes. I know what a teacher makes. And so Len would come around, and every week when you would even come to church outside the synagogue, Len would be set up and say, give me my money. How would you feel toward Len if he started working for the Russians as soon as the Russians took over the United States? He would not be one of your favorite people. Nor, I mean, you can just see Robin would be like, as sweet as she is, we'd still look at her like, how could you be married to that man? Nobody would like those people. You would wish that no one would take that job, but people unfortunately did. And they would send all that money back to the Romans. And so that brings us to the man Matthew, who he has that job. He is a social outcast, but he's willing to be a social outcast because he had the cash that goes with it. And I'll just tell you, people who weren't accepted socially back in that time, let me say it again another way. People who are well-known and popular in town, who came from well-to-do families, wouldn't want to take the tax collector job because then they would lose their status within the community because no one would like them. What type of person would be willing to say, I'll become a tax collector? It's not just a greedy one. It's someone, follow this, it's important. It's someone who has nothing to lose. Do you get that? If everyone treats you poorly and you don't have many friends and your family is not well esteemed, why would you not take the job of a tax collector? If the people in your community had always shunned you, thought you were less than them, look, they always look down on you. And the Romans come in and said, we're going to elevate you from the bottom of society to we're going to put you in charge of these people. And all these people have put you down your entire lives. Now you're going to take their well-earned cash and you're going to be the guy with the nicest horse in town. Do you get that concept? So this is Matthew. This is the type of person who would take the job. Someone who was on the outs. Someone who nobody else liked and had nothing to lose by taking this position with the Roman Empire. So here is Matthew. He's on the outside looking in. Nobody wants him. He's not welcome in the synagogues, but he's bringing in the cash. Now, he's probably a good man. And what I mean by that, he's probably honest. Because later when we see Zacchaeus come to Christ, he says, I'll pay back everybody that I've cheated four times what I've taken from them. When Matthew comes to Jesus, he doesn't say anything like that. And Jesus doesn't expect anything like that. So my guess, and it's just speculation, my guess because of the difference between Matthew and Zacchaeus is that Matthew just took his fair share, what should have been expected for a tax collector. He didn't rip anybody off. He was just doing what he was supposed to do. But yet, he was doing what he was supposed to do on behalf of the Romans. He wouldn't have been popular. So we come here to Matthew chapter 9. I just want to introduce to you the author of this book that we're about ready to read. Jesus is passing on. He's coming by through town. And he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth. Imagine somebody sitting out here on the corner. Boy, you're talking about something that would discourage church attendance on Sunday morning, right? If a tax collector was sitting out here on the corner every day and just thought, hey, I didn't see your money come in last week, okay? And then come on over here. Oh, wouldn't that be an awful thing on a Sunday morning? And Jesus said to him, follow me. And look what Matthew did. He didn't give a 2 weeks notice. He didn't go and call the Romans and say, I need to take some time off. Could I have some vacation? He just rose and he followed Jesus. Now, this is why this is so important. Don't miss this. Don't miss this. It's so important because of this. This is probably the first time that a rabbi had ever looked at Matthew and said, I think you've got something that you can contribute to the work of God. He probably would not have taken the job with the Romans if he were already on the inside of the religious system. Because he took the job, he was put out of the religious system. He probably never had it in the first place. He was probably welcome there, but sat in the back. Nobody ever gave him ministry. Nobody ever talked to him on the way in or on the way out. He just felt alone. I'm here to tell you this morning, friends, as members of our church, there are people that feel that way in a crowd of 600 or 700. And you walk by them every week. You try to say hi, but they're not included. They don't feel like they're in. Ever since they were in elementary, maybe they didn't have quite the social skills. Maybe their family didn't have the money. But they were on the outside looking in. And I really believe for the first time, when Jesus looks Matthew in the eye, that it had been a while since anybody had looked him in the eye and said, I see something in you that nobody else can see. And that's powerful. I see something in you that no one else can see. So he gets up and he follows him. And later, Jesus is reclining at the table in his house. They're in Matthew's house eating dinner. And then the only people that would hang out with Matthew were sinners, people who were also kicked out of the synagogue, and prostitutes. He had to have some friends somewhere, and he probably bought his friends with the money that he made collecting for the Romans and excising from the Jewish people. It says, behold, look, Matthew's giving you this is, he's writing this account about his life. So it says, look, he's just been doing narrative to this point. And then he says, behold, look, pay attention. He says, many tax collectors and sinners came. Now he's following Jesus, and who all is going to come and hang out with him and celebrate that now he's following a rabbi? other tax collectors. These are his only friends. And sinners, they're in the room with him. People that were outside of the synagogue. And they're reclining with Jesus and his disciples, the ones Jesus has already called. And they're all there together having a good time at the dinner. And the Pharisees see this. The business leaders of the community, don't ever forget that. The Pharisees are the business leaders, okay? And if you're a business leader, that means you make a lot of money. And typically, business leaders who make a lot of money are a part of which party? Don't say Republicans, okay? The party that hates taxes the most, right? They despise the tax collectors because they're the ones paying the taxes. And when the Pharisees saw this, they didn't go directly to Jesus because this is how evil people work. They don't go directly to the person they have the problem with. They go to the people that are friends with the people instead of directly addressing what's going on here. And then they say to his disciples, trying to turn fishermen who used to be taxed by Matthew himself. The other disciples, I'm sure when Jesus brought in a tax collector, they're like, now, wait a minute. I hate that guy. Why are you bringing in? This is not going to have good optics. This is not going to be good politics for growing the ministry, Jesus. Why are you bringing this guy into the fold? The Pharisees know how his disciples, Peter, James, John, would feel toward Matthew. So what do? They go over and like, why are you following a guy who hangs out with people like this? We watched you boys be raised up in this community. Why are you doing this? Why does your rabbi, that's word here for teacher, why does your rabbi eat with tax collectors and sinners? Jesus overhears it. He doesn't go worm it around. He just speaks it out. He says, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Now, how would you feel if you were a tax collector or a sinner at that time? Jesus said you were sick. I'm going to tell you why they weren't offended at it. Do you know why they weren't offended when Jesus said they were sick? Because they knew it. And this is part of why Jesus hung out with them, is because he wanted to be with people who realized that they needed him. You get it? He wanted to be with people who knew they had a need for a Savior, not with people who thought they were better than everybody else. And so that is at the heart of this book, is why Jesus came. You know, this book that hopefully you do have in your hand. My question to you this morning is this: why do you have it? Why is it written? Why is this so important to us? You see, the Bible isn't meant to be a religious set of rules that we follow like some transactional tax code with God. That's not why God wrote this. The Bible is meant to be a story, a love story, about a creator God, Jesus, who created all things, revealing himself through all 66 chapters of one book. And so while we refer it to the book of Matthew as a book of Matthew, it's really a chapter, one of 66 in one book, that is trying to communicate to you from God how he feels about his creation and wants to relate to his creation and how he wants his creation to relate to him. It's just a love story. It's a love letter from God to us demonstrating how he works with his creation over thousands of years. How he desires to relate to us. And every book has an author, and nearly every author of that book includes their own story. And that's what Matthew's doing here. But here's what I don't want to do, okay? I don't want to jump into this sermon series right in the middle of a novel. You ever open up a novel, it's got 66 chapters, and you start in chapter 40? Who would want to do that, right? You're like, man, you just ruined the book. You need to know what's in it. So what I want to do with you is go back to the book of Genesis, Lord willing, in about 15 to 20 minutes, I want to go back to the book of Genesis and work our way through this love story where God is revealing to us his plan for us and his creation for the ages, okay? So if you want to, if you went, that this is where you just have to have quick fingers or you can watch on the board for this, okay? I'm going to start out in Genesis chapter 1, okay? In verse 29, God has created everything in the world, and now he's created Adam and Eve, and he says to them, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth. This whole planet belongs to you. I've given it to you. And every tree with seed and its fruit, you shall have them for food. Man, it's just wide open. You can have whatever you want. You've got all you can eat buffet every day. This is your job. Just relate to me. And God would come down and walk in the garden every day with Adam and Eve, and they would have relationship with one another. This is God's love story. This is how he designed it. He wanted to have a creation that related back to him. And the Lord God commanded them in chapter 2. He says, you may surely, saying to the man, he says, you may surely of every tree eat in of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. All right? I don't want you to have anything to do with that. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. This is the only thing I'm asking from you, Adam, is this one fruit tree. There are a billion fruit trees in this earth. But this one, I just don't want you to have anything to do with it. I don't want you to eat it. Okay? Well, we all know the story, right? If you're visiting here today and you don't know the story, I'm going to summarize it. Chapter 3, the next chapter of Genesis. His wife, Adam's wife, is out. She sees the tree, all right, and that it was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desired to make one wise. And she took of its fruit and she ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. And the result of that is their eyes were opened. That's when sin entered the world and there was separation because they had violated the relationship, the agreement they had with God. And let me tell you what, it hurts when people lie to you. Don't you know that just when God says, Adam, I don't want you to do this, Adam, well, oh, Lord, I would never do anything. It hurts when you feel betrayed by someone you love. And listen, God is not above feeling pain or regret because of things that we do. Sometimes we think that God is so emotionally removed and he's up there in heaven and he's just emotionally separated from us. He's not. In the same way I'm not saying in an exact same way, but in a similar way to what you feel when someone betrays you, when we sin, God feels betrayed. When we choose sin over him, he feels betrayed. He's hurt. So we see here in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, speaking to the serpent, to Satan himself, he makes a declaration, a prophecy. He says, I'm going to put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. Now, we all know this, that when the Bible records genealogy, it usually traces it through the man, right? It might also include a woman, but when we talk about the offspring, Abraham's offspring, Isaac's offspring, Jacob's offspring, it's usually tracking through the men. But in this case, he says, there's going to be an offspring, watch this, singular, one offspring of a woman. Now, what's the relationship going to be between the singular offspring of the woman? He will bruise your head, Satan, and you shall bruise his heel. And the word here for bruise is stronger than the second word for bruise. It's the one for like crush. He will crush your head. So someday, the offspring of a woman's going to come and go to crush your head. But in the meantime, sin rules, Satan rules over the earth. And so what we see in the Bible, what a reader would do, what a Jew would do is they would read it. Okay, who is going to be that woman's offspring that crushes the head of the serpent? Who is going to come and restore righteousness to the earth? And this narrative begins thousands of years ago looking for, okay, Adam messed this up as our representative, but someone else is going to come as our representative, this offspring of the woman, and he is going to crush Satan's head. Man, we look forward to that. Who could it be? So you turn to chapter 4, and you think, oh, now it says this. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. So if you're just reading this story for the first time, you might be thinking, if you don't know how thick the book is, all right, you might be thinking, oh, maybe it's Cain. Maybe he's the one that's going to crush the head of Satan, right? And so God is speaking to Cain one day, and he says, now, Cain, listen, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, listen, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. In other words, the devil's out here like a roaring lion, sitting down waiting to pounce on you, and you've got to overcome this temptation that he's putting in your life. And so Cain says, let me think about that for a bit. And so he speaks to his brother Abel, and when they were out in the field, he says, hey, come out here in the field with me. Cain rose up against his brother Abel, and he killed his brother. So you read that, and you're like, I guess it's not Cain. Not going to be him. So much for crushing Satan's head. Satan just crushed Cain's head by getting Cain to crush Abel's head. This is a disaster. Well, that didn't work so well. So you read through a couple more chapters, and we come over to chapter 6. And it says that the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. Oh, church family, this is what I want you to see this morning, is that God feels pain. He feels grief when we act against him. And now all these descendants of Cain and the other men that were born in sin, they're going out and they're committing all kinds of evil and wickedness. And it's grieving God to his heart. And the Lord said, man, I'm just going to start all over. I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals, creeping things and birds of the heaven, for I am sorry that I have made them. Man, I just want you to feel God's heart when he's communicating his story to you. What he's saying here is, man, I feel it. I feel it. I mean, it's like these are not the words you want to hear from somebody who loves you. When a husband says to a wife or a wife says to the husband, I regret the day that I said I do. If they're saying that, it's coming out of a lot of pain. Do you understand that, church family? They're hurting when they make a comment like that. And that's why God is saying this. I regret that the day I created you. Can you imagine saying that to your children? Man, I regret the day that you were born. Why would you say that to someone? It's not just to hurt them. It's to let them know that you are hurting. So God communicates this to his people. He says, I love you. Quit hurting me. I want to have a good relationship with you. So I'm just going to, nobody here wants to listen to me, but I'm going to have grace on one person. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So when you see this, Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. He's going to wipe everybody and start again. What are you going to start thinking about Noah? Maybe he's the one. Maybe he's going to be the one. So he gets up and he creates the ark. You know the story, right? They land on Mount Ararat. They come out. He grows a garden. And what does he do? Okay. Now he began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and he became drunk, and he lay uncovered in his tent. Wah, wah, wah. Noah, you had so much promise. 120 years, all that stuff on those stinky animals in the ark, and you blew it. He's not the guy. He's not the one. So you go a couple more chapters, and you have this guy, Abram, that shows up on the scene. We don't even know anything of him, other than he's been born to this point. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your kindred, and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you. And I will, whoever dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So you read these verses and you start thinking what? Maybe Abram's the one. Maybe he's the one that's going to crush Satan's head. This is awesome. That's in chapter 12, verse 3. Then you go down just 12 verses later. The princes of Pharaoh see Abraham and his wife Sarah, and they praised her to Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh was taken into Pharaoh's house, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, now listen, what does it mean when the king takes a beautiful woman into his house? Right? And it says, for her sake, he dealt well with Abram. And he had sheep and oxen and male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, camels. He's given everything to him because he thinks that Sarah, because Abram had lied to her and said, she's my sister, didn't even say she's my wife. He's pimping out his wife here. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh calls Abram, this pagan king calls him in. calls in the man of God, and he says, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say to me, she is your sister, so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here's your wife. Take her. Go. I thought Abram would be the guy. Man, how disappointing could that be? But yet God made a covenant with Abraham that he would bless him and his offspring forever. And so he says, after Abraham has a son, he says, I will establish my covenant with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this time next year. So you see that? Now, how are you going to read this if you're a Jew? You read it like, oh, maybe Isaac's the one. Right? Wouldn't that be awesome? So Isaac grows up. He marries a beautiful woman, Rebekah, and he settles in Gerar. Guess what he does when he's in Gerar? When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, she is my sister. Where did he ever get that idea? For he feared to say, my wife, thinking lest the men of the place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. I guess it's not Isaac. And so then Isaac has a son, Jacob, and you think maybe it's Jacob. But then Jacob goes out and does a bunch of deceitful things. You're like, no, not him. Maybe it's one of Jacob's sons, Reuben. Nope, it's not going to be Reuben because Reuben went in and slept with his stepmom. Not going to be him. Well, maybe it's the next two boys, Simeon and Levi. Nope, it's not going to be him. They went out and murdered a bunch of guys. Well, maybe it's going to be Judah. Judah is awesome. Nope, not going to be Judah. He went out and tried to hook up with his daughter-in-law. Like, whoa, what a dysfunctional family this is. When's this story going to get better? 400 years pass of total dysfunction. And then Moses comes up and he parts the Red Sea and does all those miracles by God. And they go through and he gives them the Ten Commandments and writes the book of the law. And they're thinking, oh, maybe Moses is the one. And then God says through Moses, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers and sisters. It is to him you shall listen to. It is to him you shall listen. What's Moses saying? I'm not the one. I'm not him. Verse 18, God says, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put up my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. That's who's coming, but it's not you, Moses. Well, I wonder who then maybe it could be. And then a few more 100 years goes by, and you see this young teenage guy come up, and he whips this giant, and the whole nation of Israel is coming out, chasing after him, thinking, this guy is awesome. Maybe he's the one. He's of the line of Judah, of whom it was prophesied, the Messiah, the Savior of the world would come, this one who would crush the head. Maybe it's young David. And he goes out and he becomes the king, and they're saying, you are it. You are the anointed one. They even anointed him. And the word for anointed one means Messiah. They anointed him with oil like he might be the one. This could be awesome. And so then what does he do? He goes up, and then while everybody else is out fighting, he sees one of his captain's wives taking a bath on the roof down below him. And instead of turning around and going back inside the house right then, he gives a little call. Hey, won't you come up here to the king's chambers? And then all trouble breaks loose. And we realize, what about David? He's not the one either. It's just disappointment after disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. But then God says this to David. He says, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. One guy. I'm going to set up a kingdom someday from one of your offspring, and he will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And so the Jews are reading this like, this is awesome. This is awesome. And then what does David do? He has a son named Solomon, and he builds a temple, and everybody's thinking about Solomon. What? He must be the one. And then he starts marrying all these women who worship other gods, and he's making sacrifices to other gods, and then everybody realizes what? It's not him either. And so you see the rest of this story over and over after Solomon, king after king after king after king after king, with everybody hoping, maybe he's the one, maybe he's the one, maybe he's the one, maybe he's the one. But it's just followed by disappointment after disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. And the people have to be getting to the point that they're like, maybe it's never going to happen. So much so that eventually the whole place falls. The whole kingdom falls. Israel goes down, is conquered by another nation. And they're sitting in captivity, and they've got to be thinking, it's never going to happen. There's never going to be a one. No one's going to rescue us. And then God gives a vision to the prophet Daniel. He says these words. He said, 70 weeks, this is a prophetic term, a prediction, are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression. In other words, they're being punished for what they did wrong under all those kings. But then there will be, at the end of that 70 weeks, someone's going to put an end to sin. Someone's going to atone for everyone's iniquity. And someone's going to bring in everlasting righteousness. And they will seal both the vision and the prophet and to anoint a most holy place. There is going to be a temple built to God, and it's going to be without sin. Know, therefore, and understand, this is an encouraging word to the people in captivity, that from the going out of the word to rebuild and restore Jerusalem, to the coming of an anointed one, a prince. Man, that's important. What's that word for anointed one? To the coming of Messiah. And the clock starts ticking. And that's something we're going to do at Bible study tonight. We're going to demonstrate how God planned out for the ages and said, here's the clock that started ticking, and he predicted to the year, to the day that Messiah would come, this Prince of Peace, okay? And then that brings us to, you've got this time of exile, they're back in the land, you got 500-600 years, they're just sitting out there doing nothing, and then Matthew writes this story in chapter 1, verse 1. He says, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. What's he communicating in verse number 1 of this book? This guy is the one. This is the one you've been waiting for. From Genesis 3:15 until now, for thousands of years, this is the one, Jesus Christ. The word here for Christ is the Greek word for Jesus, the Messiah. Here's his genealogy. Here's the list of all the broken people that messed things up over the years, but it is through those broken people that Jesus is going to change the world. Man, isn't that good news? And he starts out, he says, Abram was the father of Isaac. And they all know Abraham and Isaac's story. Failure, failure. And Isaac, the failure, was the father of Jacob, the failure, who was the father of Judah, the failure, and his failing brothers. I mean, we all get that, right? And Judah, the father of Perez, who was a failure, and Zerah by Tamar, who was a prostitute, and Perez, the father of Hezron, and Hezron, the father of Ram, all failures, all right? And it just keeps on going down there until it gets to Jesse, a failure, the father of David, the king, who was a failure. Well, how do we know he's a failure? Well, they even mention his failure in here because he's the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. Man, what a fail. And then Solomon, a failure, was the father of Rehoboam, major failure, all right? And Rehoboam, the father of Abijah, worse failure. And Abijah, the father of Asaph, another failure. It's just going down the list, loser after loser after loser after loser. And then finally it gets down to Eliud, the father of Eleazar, loser. And Eleazar, the father of Mathan. And Mathan, the father of Jacob. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, who is the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Messiah, Christ. Now notice what it says here. He says, I'm going through the legal line through which the Messiah must come, but Joseph was just the husband of Mary. Why is that important to note? Because the Messiah must be the offspring of a woman. And this Messiah is Genesis 3:15 fulfilled. This Jesus, I want to introduce to you this story of a man named Jesus. He is the one. So the entire list is just a group of broken people looking for someone who wasn't broken to fix their brokenness. That's it. That's that genealogy list. It's a group of broken people looking for someone who wasn't broken to fix their brokenness. And Matthew was one of those broken people until Jesus said to him, "Follow me." And I look out here this morning and I almost don't want to make eye contact here. I'm just going to kind of look down because I know all of our stories. I can look in the mirror and see stories of also another broken person who was a loser, who was not the one. I see people who have struggled and are still struggling with drug and alcohol addiction, adulterers, porn addicts, liars, gossips, and then worst of all, prideful people who are sitting there thinking, "Thank God I'm not one of those other things Steve just named." Broken people. Broken people that hopefully, unlike the Pharisees, realize you are broken. I mean, do we all get that? That's the story of everybody in the Bible minus one. Broken. Dude, I'm broke. And I stand before you this morning, a broken man who somehow, by the grace of God, is allowed to deliver God's word to you every week and not be struck dead by lightning every time I walk out the door. Don't ever say I'm a good man, because I am not. And don't look in the mirror and say I'm a good person, because you're not. You're broken. And so what Matthew's going to do for the rest of this book is he's going to draw a dividing line. Now listen, close with this thought. He's going to draw a dividing line. People who are healed of the brokenness because they realize they're broken. And it's going to be filled with people coming to Jesus thinking they're not broken and resenting Jesus for trying to fix them. And there's going to be these constant watershed moments. Which side are you on? The broken people who realize they're broken, or the broken people who think they're not? And the people on this side recognize, I need help. And so that's my question this morning to you, that Matthew would ask. Do you realize you're a broken person? Do you think you're better than anybody else? Because if you realize that you are broken in a family of brokenness, Jesus is here to say to you, follow me. Follow me. And that's the invitation of this sermon series. Just follow Jesus over the next year through the book of Matthew as he reveals to you how the one guy who's going to crush Satan's head can actually fix your brokenness.